Good evening, Steele.
Good evening, Dave.
How you doing? What you been up to?
Well, Dave, I have recently been working on potty training our son.
Oh, how's that going?
Pretty
with
well.
The urine and all.
Yeah, he's got a little child-sized toilet, and so we just let him pee and poop in that. And he's real excited right now about when he pees, dumping it in the big toilet and then rinsing it out and flushing himself. That's like his, he does it, he enjoys it, he likes it.
Still, at my house, we have, like, I don't know what you would call it, but it's a narrow hallway filled with three small potties. We've moved them out of the living room, and now it's just, like, the urine hallway. It always smells like urine in there, no matter what you do with these potties. It's just the urine walkway.
I think in college, we called that Howard's room. Is that not what you guys call it at your house?
Bada bing! Boom! Burn Howard! And on that note, we've got a pleasant-smelling man with us tonight, Zach Buse.
Hey, guys.
How are you doing, Zach?
I'm good. How are you guys doing?
Terrific.
Good. Wow. How are you feeling, Zach? You ate, like, three dinners tonight, right?
Yeah. Mom's birthday, so naturally I got to finish up everyone's plate. So it's a day in the life.
Nice.
I'm exhausted and well-fed. It's a great combination to sit around and talk for an hour.
Well, don't worry. We're going to keep things exciting.
We were excited. I think that Steele might be really excited for this episode. It's going to be awesome. But we're going to talk about nerdy stuff the whole time. We're going to talk a little bit about board games. We're bringing Game of Thrones straight to you. But first, let's talk a little bit about nerdiness. So what's a time where you guys maybe truly fulfilled your highest level of nerdiness?
To establish our bona fides before we go any further into this podcast, is that what we need to do?
Yeah, no one's going to listen to you unless they can verify that this guy has some nerd cred.
So I want to tell you about a couple years of my life that I spent under working age voluntarily doing repetitive data entry, just in case you're thinking, like, I didn't have any nerd bona fides. So there used to be a computer-based baseball game for the PC system. It was called Tony La Russa Baseball 2. And the deal was, it was stocked with all of the teams in the major leagues, and then it had the historically the best players for each of the teams. So if you picked the A's, you could have Jamie Foxx was the first baseman, and Terry Steinbach might be the catcher. So players from all different eras, you know.
Jose Canseco, I hope he's on there.
You know, the thing was, when I bought the game, he wasn't in the game. But they also had an editor where you could change and update stats and rename players. And so I said, I'm going to do this, but I don't want to just do this with my favorite players. I want to do this right. So I bought what at the time was the most comprehensive statistics for every player to ever play in the major leagues. It's called the Total Baseball Encyclopedia. It was like it was like the size of the largest dictionary you've ever seen. And printed on like onion skin paper, you know, because they just had to pack it in. And I literally went through that book from A to Z, looking at every player who played in Major League history and looking at all their seasons. And if they had a season that was statistically superior to another player on one of the teams, I replaced them with that player. And so at the end of those, like, year and a half, I had the actual greatest baseball teams of all time for every franchise, season by season. And then I just simulated a bunch of years of inter-squad competition. I didn't play as many of the actual games, but I did simulate dozens and dozens of seasons with the new updated statistics. I don't know why you're laughing, Dave. You didn't do that?
No. Your bona fides, they're checked. You're in. You can discuss things for the rest of the podcast.
I literally thought this was awesome at the time. Like, it was something I was totally excited to do.
And it still is. It's so good. I hope you still have a copy of Tony La Russa Baseball 2.
As I was thinking about this, Dave, I actually felt legitimately sad that I don't have, like, the saved database somewhere. Like, it's like probably what I spent the most time in my preteen years doing, the one single project that I dedicated the most amount of time to. And I think it's just gone. I don't have any copies of it anywhere.
Well, I'm proud of you. It was a true accomplishment.
What would you have saved it on, though? I mean, do you have something that could read 3.5-inch floppy at this point?
No, I don't think. I mean, I'm sure I could find one somewhere at the university, but.
Or did you guys have the 5-inch floppy is the word?
This was just at the era that they were switching, so it was on the 3.25-inch, the hard disk.
Yeah.
High powered. It required a high powered database to run this game. You couldn't fit it on the old floppies.
You could only play half the game on one until you had to switch it out for the other floppy disk.
Yeah, and you like load the second disk. Yeah.
Awesome. How about Zach? What do you got?
What's your moment of peak nerd, Zach?
So I was a big Harry Potter guy. High school years, you know, like as the movies would come out. This was before midnight showings were really a thing. Like, we ditched school so we'd go see the early Friday morning showings. And as midnight showings came around, we'd go and see those. And then the one that came out on my mission, I totally convinced my mission companion that it was this epic saga about good versus evil and we needed to go see it on P-Day in theaters.
Is appropriate, yes.
But the pinnacle, so when 7.2 came out.
7.2. He's got the lingo.
So when that came out, you know, all my high school friends, we decided, hey, let's get together. We'll do like a mega group and we'll all just go together and we'll all cosplay. Everyone will dress up as somebody.
Can I ask a clarifying question here? You mentioned all your high school friends. At this time, you're in your like early to mid-20s and all of your friends are in high school, or these are friends from high school?
Oh, no. Oh, friends from high school.
Okay. I was hoping it was the first one, but I didn't want to make an assumption.
Most of us have been married. We weren't quite there yet, but we were pretty close. And yeah, so we dressed up. So I went as Mad-Eye Moody. I mean, I got like the Australian duster jacket, got like this leather strap. My friend who went to art school, like I got a ping pong ball that I sawed in half, put it into a piece of piping that I painted gold. And then he like made a lifelike eyeball. It was a great costume.
Commitment.
Big. I mean, all the way. Yeah. So, and naturally we decided, the only thing better than going at midnight and taking a day off of work and just a day off to just go there and be in line the whole day. And then the next day, because you didn't get home till 4 a.m. So the only thing better than that was rather than just wait in line all day, we got tickets for the whole marathon. So it was
nice.
1 through 7.2 back to back to back to back to back to back to back.
Wait, all 7 movies? And then you watched
eight movies. All in a row.
Dressed as Mad-Eye Moody.
Well, no, and the worst one was my buddy who came with me. So I went as Mad-Eye Moody from the get-go, got it back on before the 7.2 came out. But then my buddy went as Voldemort, like taped his nose down with prosthetics, could not breathe through his nose for like 5 hours. A solid 5 hours. Full makeup, the bald cap on. His was serious, and he's just singing the whole movie, and all I can hear was the.
He ended up getting hospitalized with hypoxia, huh?
And halfway through the movie, he just couldn't take it anymore, so he rips off the whole prosthetics. So I look over, he's sitting right next to me, and it's just this dripping white skull of sweat and paint coming off with, like, this beak of a. Like, his beak's, like, hanging halfway off with the prosthetic. It was great. And then on top of all that, so then there was these costume contests. And if you've never been to a midnight showing of, like, a super nerdy, I'm talking like a Star Wars, Lord of the Rings, Harry Potter, go to one at a big popular theater in a big town because it's – and there's costume contests, there's trivia things, it's a whole production they put on. So this costume contest, we all enter, and then – so, you know, the whole thing is judged by like a applause meter, and the winner got an iPod Touch. And while I clearly won the popular vote, the guy who won even said like, yeah, your cheers were louder than mine. I took second. So instead of the iPod Touch, I got a Walmart special 18-speed mountain bike.
Nice.
So it was a good time.
Did you ride it home as Mad-Eye Moody?
No, like 4 a.m. to go pick it up. Like, I won a picture of a mountain bike, but I had to drive to their corporate office.
Oversized check with mountain bike written in the...
Jeez, you guys are both bona fide and I'm thinking of what I was going to share, and it's just not good enough. But I just remembered. So guys, you know, of course, I love the Incredible Hulk, and I in my closet right now, I have about 300 issues of Incredible Hulk comic books, and I've read multiple of them to my 3-year-old daughters. But when I was about 12, I bought this Hulk comic book. It was called Future Imperfect, Part 1. Unbelievable. I read it, super excited. I went back to the comic shop. I could never find Future Imperfect, Part 2. Flash forward a decade later, I'm still searching. I finally ordered off the internet. It's so good, guys. I just read them both again last night. And just to prep for this day, I'm ready. Even though we're not talking about the Hulk, it puts my heart in the right spot.
Wow, Dave, that's a story of like perseverance. You finally came good. Childhood's complete. The story arc is there a Future Imperfect part more than two?
No, it's just a 2-part story. It's beautiful. Present Hulk, which was, you know, like 1992, is facing Future Hulk, who has this huge beard. Just a great showdown between two Hulks. And psychological thriller, really, because, you know, facing your future self, it's really difficult to do.
Yeah.
So, guys, on to...
Oh, my goodness, his beard looks amazing. He's like a Santa Hulk.
he's not quite as jolly as Santa. He's a mean Hulk. Oh. Yeah, he does what he wants, still. So, guys, we have a new segment, Off the Chain Board Games.
Boom.
This is specifically why Zach is here. When I first met Zach, I invited him to play some board games with me and my friend Robbie. And before I knew it, Zach was way more into board games than I ever was. And he owns 30 or 40 more than I own now. He loves board games. So tonight we're going to talk a little bit about a couple board games we love. But I got to ask Zach, like, why? Why do you love board games so much?
I think deep-rooted within myself is this spirit of competitiveness and wanting to be better than other people. But on the outside, I'm not built for sport. So board games are a great way that I can go ahead and I can dominate and just decimate other men who think themselves on the same caliber as myself, but really they're just...
They're lesser specimens, really.
Exactly. They're not quite up to par with my Herculean mind.
So I have a question about this, actually, because I don't know if this is the case, but I feel maybe the last 10 to 20 years, there's been a huge flowering and flourishing of complex, interesting board games. I remember when we were children, there was like a set of standard board games, but they were essentially for children. And maybe Dungeons and Dragons was just taking off, but now there's board games for adults, and they're huge, and they're complex, and they're really interesting. What's the story behind the growth of board games as an adult pastime?
So you got to go back to World War II, actually. So
are you serious?
Modern board games, we know it now, really developed in Europe. So what happened is post-World War II, Germans were super – the history that's been explained orally and passed down to me was the Germans were very concerned that they didn't want to do anything that was resembling any kind of warfare or – games they played. So while we were playing Risk, they said, no, we can't do that. We need to do things like, build a farm before, Farmville came out on cell phones. figure out some kind of worker placement, engine driving games where you're manipulating stock markets in order to make your performance work better. So from there, it went down to France, who they started this program called Spiel des Jahres, which is kind of... It's like the Oscars of board games that happens every single year. And then once things got big and popular enough, some stuff got over to the United States. And I'd say the one that kicked it off here would probably be Settlers of Catan as far as the modern game.
And that was a German-invented game?
Yeah, so that one started in Germany. I'm trying to remember the designer's name. And Dave, you really need to talk to board games about Robbie. If you guys want to talk to
Hans Gruber. No, it's not Hans Gruber. That's
I'm
the
pretty sure
villain.
That's from Die Hard.
No, he also invented a board game. That's how he made his millions. That's how he was able to hire all those terrorists to take on John McClane.
He used that as his seed money to
his settlers' money, yeah. He sold a ton of wheat resources.
Totally. He probably had a monopoly on
that's a monopoly. Nice.
Or a 3-for-1 port.
So I feel like this is a perfect explanation because I'm like, all right, that makes sense. The Germans' love of elaborate rules, like, begins this thing. Like,
exactly.
Adults playing complicated, elaborate, rule-based things. The French love giving awards and having festivals to celebrate local culture or whatever. So, like, it's a natural thing. And then Americans love taking other people's stuff, pretending it's their own, and making it super popular.
And then just totally bastardizing it, too. Because within modern board games, there's, like, there's the Euro game, and then there's the Ameritrash genre.
Really? So it's, like,
and generally,
dumber, faster, easier.
Right, yeah. I mean, the Euro ones, it's like, you know, you've got wooden pieces that represent corn, and this is a person, and it's a little tiny wood, very simple. Then you get the American ones, and it's these, like, incredibly detailed zombies. Actually, I just got these ones the other day.
Now, this is radio, so you're going to have to tell us what we're seeing here.
You're looking at Zombicide and Zombicide Prison Outbreak.
Classics of German design. Zombicide Prison Outbreak is huge in Berlin right now.
And then within the board game community, there's this trading and there's this subculture that happens purely because there's the internet. So there's this whole website called Board Game Geek where you can develop your own person and then you put in your collection, what you've owned in the past. And from there, they do mass trades as well where you can go in, you can say, hey, I want all these games, I own these that I'm willing to trade, you put it into this logarithm that then spits out like, all right, person A, you're going to give this game to person B, person B is going to pass their game to person C, and person C is going to pass to person A. So everyone's they're getting rid of stuff they don't want anymore while getting new things that they want. So the Zombicides here, I got those purely for math trade purposes just because Barnes & Noble, they'll do their half off, and then if you wait a certain amount of time, everything goes down to $4. So you get there day one, and you hide all the games that you want behind crappier, like a giant family version of the Game of Life and thought puzzles. I'll go and I'll hide all the games behind there, wait the 2 months until everything goes to $2, and then get the games for nothing.
Wow.
Zombicide.
This is awesome because I feel like the internet truly is a wonderful gift, especially for like these niche subculture things and being able to unite disparate fan culture from all over the world. That's a really, like, it makes sense that the flourishing of board games in a kind of perverse, not a perverse way, but a kind of surprising way, because board games are the ultimate in like non-technological connectivity. It's a bunch of people playing socially in a room, but the internet facilitates the love for these analog things, you know?
And Zach, one of the things that you've been into, I haven't done as much, that I think has facilitated a lot of really interesting games, at least I've played with you, is Kickstarter. And I think one of the games you want to talk about, you got from Kickstarter, right?
There's a whole bunch of my collection that I've gotten from Kickstarter. I think the one, we're talking Agricola and Viticulture, right?
Sure.
All right, so...
And Zach is walking around his house right now because he wants to show us more, I think. I don't know what he wants to do.
I don't have the headphones, and my wife started watching a movie, and
okay.
I went to bed in our bedroom.
Okay.
So you're going to get the ghostly version of me poorly lit outside. Yeah, so Viticulture, and so it's a combo game. It originally started as a game called Viticulture, and then the expansion was Tuscany that I backed. It's developed by a guy named Jamie Stagmeier, who's probably the most successful Kickstarter campaign board game of the Euro genre out there with between those two games, Scythe, Between Two Cities. I mean, he launches the game on Kickstarter and he'll raise, I think Agricola raised $4 or $5 million.
Jeez.
I mean, it's pretty substantial amounts of money. And the games that come, I mean, it's not like your standard cheap version of Monopoly where it's paper money. I mean, they come in and it's like resin cast resources that you're playing with and every single different little meeple character, the little people you're playing with. You know,
meeples?
This color, they look one way.
Hold on.
Meeples, yeah.
Rewind that word. They're called meeples?
They're called meeples, yeah. Miniature people.
Yeah.
Oh, I love
Duh.
It.
Come on.
Come on, get down with the lingo.
I'm trying. Listeners at home got to catch up here. This is nice.
Yeah, and then, I mean, it's just, I remember actually when I played with you, Dave, a month or two ago, your neighbor that you invited had never played a game like this in his life. And I brought Scythe, which was also a Stagmeier game. And I remember him just commenting. He hated the game, hated the experience altogether, but just couldn't stop commenting about how awesome the quality of the parts were.
Well, like the money was actual metal and stuff. It was ludicrous. But it's really neat that and they can make and establish these kind of games and reach the market they want to through Kickstarter. And yeah, I've played a number of those games with you. They're awesome. They're really cool. And I think that being on Kickstarter, to a certain extent, it has to challenge the game creator and push them a little bit further to make cooler stuff.
Yes and no. I mean, I think anytime you're trying to get a game out to the masses, you got to do something cool and unique to make your particular farming game or worker placement or whatever kind of niche within the niche of board gaming you're trying to capture. You got to figure out something specific to you. But what's great about Kickstarter is it allows them, it gets them the funds in hand so they can go ahead and they can get that printing made up. So it's, you know, otherwise you're just stuck with whatever Milton Bradley and Hasbro are willing to put out. And then by giving that money up front and then waiting generally 6 months to 6 to 9 months, I think, average, you get these exclusives that only come through Kickstarter campaigns.
That's really a kind of cool model, I think. Yeah, you've sort of developed a loyalty to like a subscriber model to this guy's growing portfolio of interesting games.
Yeah, for sure.
So let's each maybe... We all picked a game or two that we wanted just to talk about just for a minute. So let's each, you know, take an opportunity. So maybe tell us just a little bit about Viticulture, like the gameplay and kind of why you're drawn to it.
So within Viticulture, it's a standard worker placement game, meaning you have so many guys that you're dealing with that, and you're trying to, the whole thing, you're trying to build a winery. So you're trying to get grapes planted. You're trying to get your crops irrigated, things picked.
Just a super compelling theme.
Right.
Like everybody's thought at some point in their life, I want to build a winery, but they just don't know where to start.
Or they want to build an actual winery, but then they realize that they have neither the time nor the money nor the land to do so. So this is a great escape because it's pretty much the exact same thing. And so within the game, you know, it's you're trying to balance your lack of people to do the best jobs they can at, you know, selectively saying, you know what, I need to get my Chardonnays in, so therefore I need to plant more red grapes. Get them into the barrels, get them aged just the right amount, but not too much because then they go bad. Figure out the best markets to take them to. And you're trying to do all the, and you know, and every single one of these actions takes another guy, and you only have so many guys to deal with, and you're trying to just strike a balance within everything.
So
how about you, Dave? What are your favorite games?
So we talked about Robbie a minute ago. Robbie's our buddy that got us both way into games. The first time I ever played one of these more complex, interesting games with him, we played Power Grid, which is still one of my favorite games. I own it now, and it's super fun. It's basically a map of the U.S. You can get different maps, and you're building power stations throughout the U.S., and you're trying to be the first one to power the most cities. And you're buying different power plants, nuclear, wind power, coal powered, whatever, as you go through. And it's just a kind of a back and forth bidding. You're trying to get the best power network. I don't know if that sounds compelling, but it's a really cool game. And it's what got me into playing all these kind of nerdy games.
Huh. And then also with that one, Dave, as the game progresses, your power stations start with, you're doing like some crappy coal plants that can only power 2 or 3 homes, all the way up to nuclear fission, and you're passing, you know, garbage plants and subatomic plants, and so there's all these different kinds of plants you can get as well.
I feel in awe a little bit because I feel like very normcore here. You guys are like describing the deep joys of very complicated, fun-sounding board games, and I'm like, have you guys heard of Candyland? That's kind of what I think I'm about to contribute to the discussion. But it sounds great. I wish I had friends, first of all. And second, if I wish I had friends I could play board games with, almost is how I feel listening to you guys talk. The one game that I've played that I like, that I feel like I'm good at, that I enjoy playing and get that competitive like blood about, are the Ticket to Ride games. And I'm sure people know these. They're, I think, quite popular. Days of Wonder, I think, is the maker, and there's you build like a train network between several cities, and the one that I like best is the Ticket to Ride Europe game.
And that's a fun game, and that's kind of like an entry level to all these kind of nerdy games. So if that's something you enjoy, then I think you'd be into all this stuff. It's super fun, but
I know I would.
But Steele, you and me, we just real quick, we both picked one similar game, Stratego. That
classic
that
person.
I loved Stratego when I was a kid. I think that helped me get me into board games. But at one point in my life, I kept beating my dad at Stratego until it was like every night my dad challenged me at Stratego. It was like a month straight. It was the greatest winning streak of my life until finally he beat me. And we stopped playing it all the time. But that's kind of where part of my love of board games started from.
Taking on dad in Stratego, one of the great moments of your life. Yeah. You had a stretch there, Dave, where you were unbeatable.
Yes. Last week we talked with Jack about some time when we were world class at something. I should have said the time I was world class at Stratego. My dad couldn't get past any of my defenses. He had no chance.
Yeah. Even with his scouts and his miners working hard to take your defenses, nope, your marshal was just bam, bam, picking them off.
I don't know if I've ever played a game of Stratego.
Oh, it's terrific.
It's good.
I remember there was a Lord of the Rings Stratego in our game closet growing up, but I never played it.
You blew it. But we love board games. It's funny. Of all my friends I play board games with, the only one that, like, we actually get, like, legitimately competitive with and get kind of angry at each other is Zach. Like, everybody else, it's just like we're having a good time, we're having fun. Like, oh, board games are awesome. But if it's me and Zach, like, there could be bad blood. It's awesome.
And I think that goes back and forth with, because I have nobody else that I've ever played with that I get mad at.
That's cute, guys. I love it. You guys are like angry board game buddies.
It could be just I know you better. Like, we're actually friends outside of board game night, whereas everybody else, I just see them to play board games, and I don't want to step on their toes. I don't want to make things too personal, lest I never be invited back to the group.
I feel like that's part of the reason why I'm kind of a little fearful of playing board games often, is that I know that there is a big part of my past that was very competitive, and I've mostly suppressed it. But if I'm playing board games, I'm, like, out to win. And I like playing with my family because I'm like, boom, I beat all of you. And they can't do anything about it because they're family, you know. But I don't want other people that I'm getting to know, like, forming their opinion of me to see this, like, ruthless competitor. Like, I will beat you at this meaningless thing.
That's the thing, though, is with family. I mean, you're so unreached. Like, you will say things that are so mean and terrible to your siblings that you would never say to a friend, a coworker. Complete stranger you treat better than your family half the time.
True, especially at a board game table.
Yeah, and so, you know, I feel like I've played with family, I've played with close friends, and I've played with just these gamer guys. And the guys who are just into the hobby that I play with on a regular basis, it's super cordial. But as soon as you get siblings on the table, no.
You're not complimenting anything good that they do. You're just like deeply resentful of any kind of positive success they have in the board game.
Well, and with siblings, I feel like you're getting back to them at all those times that they were always 20 pounds heavier than you growing up, and finally you found the thing that you can wail at them in. You know, you've never beat them at pick up basketball in the driveway, but you bust Stratego out and you can just mop the floor with them.
That's exactly it. That's like the whole secret of Dave's, like, that's how he resolved his Oedipal complex, by beating his dad at Stratego for several months.
With a complete stranger, it's a blank slate. So you can go ahead, you can wail on each other all night long, but then at the end of the day, you had a great time. And that's it. You've got no personal skin with them, no personal beef.
So guys, get ready for this smooth transition. Competition can get very personal. Games can escalate until they're a matter of life and death. And we're, of course, now talking about the Game of Thrones.
And I just want to say at the outset, if you have not read all of the books, including like the sub books, and or watched all of the television show, you should stop listening to the podcast for the next half an hour or whatever, because we don't care about spoilers. We're talking about Game of Thrones at a deep level right now. Get out of the podcast if you're not ready to get stuff spoiled. Just want to put that out there.
So, Steele, Zach, I understand why you might like this, but still, why? Why do you care? Why do you love Game of Thrones? And Zach, you know, throw that in too, but it's dragons and wolves and everybody's dressed funny and talking weird. Like, why do you care?
The reason why I like Game of Thrones, like, first of all, it's gripping, compelling narrative. And you're seeing, like, humans vying for survival and mastery in a kind of a messed up world. But the thing that makes it really interesting to me is that it's genre fiction in which the author clearly doesn't care about some of the core predictable conventions of the genre. It's genre fiction which attempts to, like, present something that approaches more of, like, a bleak but realistic view of the world. So anyone can die at any time. And I'm like, yep, I respect that book because it seems like the bleak view of life that I actually hold. You know, we were talking about The Road, Dave, and I was like, there's something about that kind of core orientation to, like, brutal honesty about human failings that's at the core of Game of Thrones. So, like, Ned Stark gets beheaded in the first book, and that's your first sign that you're like, guess what? This is not the fantasy novels that I grew up reading.
And to this, through all these books, he is probably still the most likable character that's ever been introduced in Game of Thrones. I still love Ned. And he got killed in the first book.
And he was killed quickly and swiftly without much resistance. He was still basically oblivious at the time of his own death. Like, he was out fast. And so you realize, wait, the morality that I bring to me, like the hero that I think I'm going to have, is not long for this world. I better reorient myself. That's a kind of cool move by the author.
I think he plants their shocks throughout the series. Like, what's the biggest shock you've had watching or reading this stuff?
I mean, Ned Stark's death was definitely, for sure, the first big punch in the gut. Where, I don't know if I'd say the most likable character, but definitely the most benevolent and the most virtuous of all characters in the book. Where it was, he was just purely about doing good and doing
honor.
Good for others.
Honor, yeah. Duty, all the stuff that's supposed to matter.
And doing it, not because he was trying to be pretentious or be better, but just because that's just what you did. And then outside of that, I mean, the Red Wedding was definitely the other one where you've got more Starks who've got this fantastic alliance, you think, and they're in there with the Greyjoys, and you think everything's hunky-dory, they've teamed up, life is good, and then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, everyone just dies. Stark gets killed.
And brutally, at a wedding.
Brutally, yeah, completely brutal. His pregnant wife is stabbed multiple times through the stomach. Catelyn Stark, Ned's wife, he gets her throat completely slit.
And she takes out the court idiot, like, as a last desperate gesture. She kills somebody, like, in her last, and it doesn't matter, and you're just like, oh man, this is bad.
Well, and then all the minor characters that are part of the House Stark, that are the assistants and the
stablemen,
the helpers,
unknowingly slaughtered.
And the whole army outside the castle, they're all slaughtered.
I talked to both of you guys, I think, after I read this. I was reading just between seeing Patience, and I was reading that, and I've never been shocked more by any fictional thing in my entire life. I once that chapter was done, I closed the book, I paced back and forth in my office, and I couldn't think about anything else for the rest of the day. I don't even know if I kept reading the book. I had to just process what on earth had just happened.
You knew that somebody was going to be dying at some point. Not necessarily at the wedding, but just the gravity and the magnitude of how many people died in that wedding. And it was hundreds and hundreds of Starks and Stark Bannermen.
Yeah.
And he did it again because Ned, you felt like, is the main character of this series of books. And then it passed on, and I kind of felt like the narrative didn't always focus on Rob, but I thought, like, okay, now it's Rob. Rob's the one that's going to see me through this entire narrative. But then he's dead.
Well, you feel like Rob's the one that you can get behind, you can root for, and you can say, yeah, there's a good man who can lead and
he's going to grow into leadership. He's going to grow into never defeated in battle. He's like this, you know, too good to be true. And then,
and so handsome.
Yeah.
So handsome.
Oh. They all are. I guess we're already discussing this, really, but how did this become like a cultural phenomenon? Like, this is usually something that's just kind of left to the nerds, but everybody loves it.
And it's interesting, too, because there are very strong elements of horror, of, like, really, really bad things. And yet, it attained a certain widespread popularity that's kind of surprising. And I don't know how to explain it exactly other than it took a long time. Like, the books first came out 20 years ago. And they are of a remarkably high, I think, literary quality for the genre.
Mm-hmm.
So in part, I think it's a story of just quality winning out. You have a story of that complexity and that narrative quality that eventually it's going to find its audience, and smart people are going to want to make like engaging art from it and with it and out of it. And so it helped with the TV thing. And I guess it's maybe the moment where cable TV needs content. And so you have like a HBO provider that can make real, like, graphic, gruesome TV that also needs this content in a niche market. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. And I think that it's driven by the discussion we're just having. The fact that this guy's ready to go outside the genre and allow these main characters to be killed. I probably would have enjoyed the books if Ned was still alive and still the driving force throughout all the books. I probably still would like it, but it wouldn't be like burned into my memory the moment when Ned's head was chopped off. Like, that's almost like a real memory I have.
The book is willing to hurt you. Like, it's willing to not just reward you and not just be a place to escape, but the book is willing to, like, hurt you.
See, in my mind, I have the same feelings and types of memories of when Ned died or when have you guys watched the show? Did you guys watch the last season?
I've watched the show.
So the whole thing with Hodor, when you figure out why he's named Hodor.
That's like, that's crushing.
But I have the same kind of, like, those memories are stored in the same place. This is going to sound terrible, but it's like in the same part of my brain and heart as like 9/11.
You're like, you've got like a never forget patch with Hodor's face on it that like you're voting with now.
That episode was completely devastating.
Yeah, so I think that there's tons of moments like this, but the other thing that I really appreciate, so about the book, I have a coworker who's a historian by training, and I was like, yeah, you need to read these books, and so he did. And he's loving all these like medieval history parallels and all this other stuff. But we were talking about the fake Aegon Targaryen, whether he's real or fake, you know, the kid who's suddenly coming out of hiding with John Connington at the end here. And Varys kills the Lannister uncle, Kevin Lannister, right before he kills him, he tells him, yeah, this is Aegon Targaryen and we're going to restore him to the throne. And so my coworker's like, oh, this means that he's a real Targaryen, because in the medieval literature genre, whenever someone's about to die or about to kill someone, like right before death, it's always a moment of radical, total truth. You cannot lie right before you're either executed or you kill somebody. And I was like, actually, I know that's the convention of the genre, but I feel like Martin's repeatedly telling us, yeah, I know these are the conventions, but you know what? I don't care. It could be otherwise. Like, even that moment, like the sacrosanct, you must tell the truth right before you kill someone or you die. Like, Varys could be lying right before he kills a dude. In which scenario, he has no reason to lie because the guy's about to die, but he still might be lying. And that for me is like one of those moments that I'm like, just having that conversation with today, I was like, there are very few like works of literature that I feel like both play along with these conventions in really satisfying ways, but also is totally ready to like twist, subvert, and change them in a way that always just keeps you reading and like guessing and wondering and theorizing. And I mean, it masters the genre instead of being mastered by it.
Because I think he's still willing to throw you satisfying stories,
yes,
satisfying things, even when he's willing to shock you. When Joffrey was finally killed, it felt like a weight was taken off me. Like, I was like, thank you, George. Like, I really, really needed you to do that.
There is some justice in this world. You asked us, Dave, what the most satisfying death was. I actually felt like it was a Viserys Targaryen, the Targaryen brother that gets the crown of gold from... I was like, that guy's such a prick, you know? And I hate wishing death on anybody, but I was like, all right, let's focus on the real Targaryen who matters now.
I got to go with Ramsay. As soon as Ramsay finally got killed off in this last season.
So this hasn't happened in the books yet for Dave, so.
has not happened in the books. So, Dave, do you want to just mute it at this point, or?
You can go because
Ramsey in the TV show is so different than the Ramsey in the books.
Everyone's gonna die at some point. You accepted that. Valor Morghulis,
guys.
So, but with him, he's just such an awful, terrible, manipulative person who just loves torturing people and doing the most gruesome. I mean, he makes Joffrey look human. I mean, he's that much worse. And when Sansa finally is able, she's got him captured. He's tied up, and he's thinking, you know, he's gonna get like a sword through the chest or some kind of standard, typical death, but. Instead, he's been starving these war dogs, these hounds for days, you know, leading up to being able to throw Jon Snow or whoever else he captures from Jon's army. And instead of being able to throw one of his prisoners into him, Sansa just opens up the gates, lets the hounds out, and they just go to town on his face. Just eaten alive by his hounds, and you're just sitting there and you're like, who's a good boy?
Oh yeah, it's bad. It's bad.
But you love those dogs and that look that Sansa has coming out of like just that sly smirk where she's like, I got you. Sadistic son of a bee, I got you and I win.
So there's so many characters in these books, and it's interesting how he weaves the tales and how at different points you feel sympathetic to characters, different points you hate the same character. There's just so many interesting ones. What's some of your favorite ones that have been in the stories?
I love Davos Seaworth.
Uh-huh.
He's my guy. And I actually would say, like, I also – this is another related question. Who is your true and rightful king? Like, who do you back to sit atop the Iron Throne? Like, if you have to be like, all right, who's my king?
Jeez.
Or queen.
It's a king. Come on. I guess Danny. I don't, oh, man.
You're not a Cersei Lannister fan, Dave?
No. Of all the weaving and tales, I've never felt sympathetic towards Cersei at this point.
No.
I don't think it's happening. And guys, I just read this. I don't know how to actually say the names because I still haven't convinced my wife to watch it, which is another question. I don't know how to convince her to watch it. But Tyrion, how do you say his name?
Yeah, that's right.
You got it.
Yeah. So I just that guy's great.
He's the best.
Just the comedic relief, and I think like the real like challenge of his life of being a dwarf. Yeah, just and how he deals with everything. I'm always entertained by him. So I'll make him my king too.
I've got a Tyrion theory.
Okay.
He's a Targaryen.
How?
So the Mad King goes and visits King's Landing to see the young twins, and he's like he's got his hands all over the queen, and it really pisses off the Lannister dad. So I think that he basically exerts King's right and takes the Lannister wife, rapes her essentially, and then Tyrion is the son of the Mad King and the Lannister mother. And that's why the dad is always like, you're not my son and you killed your mother. And like, and that's why he's also blonde and kind of weird. That's my theory. My theory is that he's a bastard child of the dead Mad King, which is why he's going to be riding a dragon before the thing is over.
We can all hope. And the crown will be put on his head at some point.
That'd be cool.
I don't think he wants it. I think of all the characters, yeah. I think
he'll be the hand. He'll be the hand of the king.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
But I don't think being the king, that's nothing that I think he wants. No, in my opinion, I mean, definitely Danny, but what I would love to see is a Danny-Jon Snow combo.
It's going
to
happen, too. Because he's also, I mean, obviously, he's the son of Lyanna and Rhaegar.
Yeah, definitely.
So I'm all in on Stannis. Stannis is my true and rightful king. He's the guy with the legitimate claim. I mean, I don't
know. Not more legitimate than Danny.
My experience with the books was they were books on tape going to and from work. So I'm much more of an ardent fan of the shows versus the books. And in the shows. Yeah, in the shows, he sacrifices his daughter, Shireen, to the Lord of Light so he can win the battle. And his entire army just gets murdered. He sacrifices his daughter. So in my opinion, like, that's just the memory I have with him. On top of that, like, too much of a hard ass.
Yeah.
He can't get it done. He's not going to be a leader because he won't bend for anything.
But here's the thing, though. The show is asking you to judge these rulers or the leaders by the person they inspire loyalty in. So you can tell how quality a person is by, like, who their right-hand man or their second-in-command is. Look at Dany. She keeps attracting, like, these losers, and then she gets Tyrion, and that's going to be, like, her key to success. Once Tyrion's on her side, she's going to rise. You look at the Stannis' right-hand man, and it's, like, Davos Seaworth, who's, like, the freaking coolest dude. Like, look at who the right-hand person is for the Lannister family. Like, it's just a bunch of lickspittles, and they're just going to hell in a handbasket, right? Like, everybody else, the second-in-command, is, like, the crucial key to see how cool of a king or a leader they are.
Tyrion was the hand of Joffrey long before he was the hand of Dany.
Yeah. But no, Joffrey didn't want him, though. That's the thing.
Well, I mean, he was appointed by his father in his father's absence.
Yeah. So that's Robert Baratheon had Ned Stark. He was cool, and then they both got killed, and, you know, I don't know.
Okay. You're still in Stannis' corner. That's great. I'm glad someone's supporting him.
But, Zach, your favorite character. We didn't hear who your favorite character was.
Favorite character, I'd probably have to go with Arya.
Whoa.
I mean, it's Arya and then Varys. I love Varys.
Yeah? Why?
He's one of the other... So, I would argue of everyone on the show, he legitimately has the most true power and manipulative capabilities of anybody on there.
What about he and Littlefinger are like hand in hand for me on that?
And Littlefinger's definitely right up there with him. And I feel like Varys just has a slight edge over Littlefinger, purely because at the end of the day, Varys, like Tyrion, doesn't want the throne.
Mm.
He has zero ambition to rule. He just wants to be in some kind of position where he can manipulate the higher people to be in order to do the greatest benefit for the whole kingdom.
Yeah, he's a king maker rather than a king himself, right? That's the real difference. Yeah, interesting.
Well, and the fact that he's willing and capable of doing some of the most atrocious and heinous things, but at the end of the day, he only does it for the betterment of the kingdom and the people.
I don't know if I believe that. I know that I think that's what he says, but I'm not sure.
I'm not sure. And then Arya's just awesome.
Yeah. She's like the god of vengeance in the story. And she's like an angel of death. And it's hard not to like be sort of in awe of her as a kind of terror. She's sort of like a character out of a Cormac McCarthy story, Dave.
Yeah, you can't help but root for her. I want her to kill everybody that she wants to kill. I'm totally in her corner.
They bring you in as like she's this awesome, lovable tomboy who doesn't want to be a lady of the court. She doesn't want to sit around and do seeming all day long. She wants to get out and she wants a sword fight and she wants to rustle around and be one of the boys. And so you get into her corner and you root for her and you're like, yeah, all the way. And then she sees her father just brutally murdered in front of the entire city. And then from there just goes into this complete downward spiral.
Well, she also, don't forget, she shows up at the Red Wedding 5 minutes too late, right? Like where she's like, she's riding up with the Hound right as they realize her whole family is getting slaughtered. Right when you think she's going to get reunited with everybody.
Oh, jeez.
You know, like, that's the part where you're just like, come on, man. You're like, fuck.
But after all those things happen, I mean, if they started Arya in the beginning where she is now, you know, just as far as just the complete angel of death she's turned into, you wouldn't be on her side. I mean, she's, by all means of the word, like, she's a psychopath. She's a completely psychopathic murderer who just wants to kill anybody who's ever crossed her. And even people who don't necessarily deserve death, deserve justice, but not, certainly not death.
But because of her backstory, you're like, you know what? I also want to kill everyone who's ever wronged you, is kind of what you're saying. Like, it stirred your sympathies in, like, sick ways.
Right. And even though it may be people who I'm kind of on their side too, but you want to kill them, so yeah, go ahead.
So should we rank the Starks? Dave, you suggested this. I'm curious to see how you'd rank the Starks.
So let's discuss this. Like, are we just ranking them right at this moment overall, you know, dead and everything?
Well, and what are we ranking them for? Are we ranking them as far as Starks we'd love to see lead the North? Are we saying, like, Starks I'd love to have as a roommate, or Starks I'd love to go...
Clearly Rickon.
How are we ranking? Because they rank very differently in that matter.
All right. Jeez. Well, I think just, like, personal favorite. Like, which character you, like the most. I don't know. What were you thinking, Dave?
Yeah, I'm thinking just best Stark, however you define that. Give me your top three Starks.
I think it's got to be Arya, Rob, Ned. Probably in that order. Maybe Arya, Ned, Rob.
How about you, Dave?
Which is, I can't remember the disabled boy's name now.
Bran.
I like Bran. I still love Ned. I got Ned number one. He's just my traditional hero. And I'll go Ned, Arya. I'm going to go Bran.
Arya, Rob. Can I put one of the wolves as number three?
Yeah, that's a good choice.
It's up to your definition.
Yeah, let's go ahead. Summer. I'll put Summer as my third favorite.
Not Shaggy Dog?
Shaggy Dog, he's all right. He's Shaggy Dog, though. He's the wild wolf. The wild wolf that was for a wild boy.
So none of us mentioned Jon Snow.
He's not a Stark. He's a bastard.
Nah, he's a Stark. Okay, maybe not. Well, the other question that I was going to ask, though, is the books and the TV show, I think, have diverged on this point. But in the books, I'm talking about the book universe, because the TV show universe is fun, but it's not real canon to me. It's like fake fun. I'm a book loyalist. In the books, are you convinced that Bran is like a good character?
And are he's doing right?
Or that he's going to be on the good side in the end? Or is he, could he be, I feel like in the books, it's like, it's kind of ambiguous, and he might be like going to be teaming up with the others and doing some bad stuff, like destroying humans and not exactly like, I don't know where I stand with the Green Seers and the children and the others and all that stuff in the books.
I think that in a general way, yes, he will be good. Not necessarily from the perspective of others, but from the perspective of the land and the magic and whatever. He's a good force, but it's not necessarily going to always do good in the sight of other Starks, for instance.
Because the old guy, Bloodraven, is he, like, he doesn't seem to be, like, a morally good character. He seems kind of suspect, and he's, like, the mentor for Bran, and Bran's going to be, like, the new three-eyed raven or whatever, right?
Well, just that whole side story is, it's a more fantastical, a little more out there story. Yeah, it seems like if George doesn't know what he's doing, that could turn out just kind of crappy. That could be like the end of Lost. Like, you never really explain what's going on with Bran and like why all this crap happened with Bran.
The TV
and
show,
and even the others, it feels like all that stuff could just kind of crap out.
The TV show has introduced this possibility of Bran as a time traveler who can influence the past. And I'm really not liking that as a direction.
That seems stupid.
But what they were able to do with it was...
Oh, heartbreaking. Yeah.
Some of the most tragically beautiful TV watching you've ever experienced.
Yeah, yeah, it's like...
I think there is some extent of that, though, in the book, that he can view past events and stuff.
And people sort of look at him as if he's there, and I mean, I just don't know.
Yeah.
And the thing with the whole manipulating the past, the only time that was ever able to happen was only when his connection to the past at that point was via the Three-Eyed Raven. And when the Three-Eyed Raven died in the present, he lost that link and had to jump into some other kind of link to bring him back via Hodor, who was there. So as far as manipulating the past, no, I mean, because he keeps going back to outside that tower with Ned over and over and over again. You know, and everything else, I think it was just that one-time fluke that where he needed to be able to figure out a way to get back into his present body from where he was in the past. I mean, and after they showed that episode, they showed the showrunners where they were talking about how they talked with George R.R. Martin about the origin of Hodor, and it seemed like something that George R.R. Martin was the mastermind behind the whole thing. It wasn't like something that the showrunners just kind of came up with, like Shireen's death.
Okay, that one.
So I think
we got to wait.
Let's bring it back. Let's reel it in a little bit here.
I have another question.
Can
I ask one, Dave?
Yeah.
I want to know who you support to sit on the Iron Throne, but I also want to know what god you worship in this world.
I think the answer's obvious with me. I'm such a Ned apologist that I got to go with the old gods. Although the drowned god, just the pure nightmare terror of following that, just the religious zealots following that is pretty compelling, but I'm with the old gods. Those guys are great.
The idea of being drowned to death every time you're about to do something significant in your life. didn't reel you in.
That's pretty awesome. Yeah. Like, those guys are friggin' committed still. They're not messing around.
Yeah, seriously.
See, part of me feels like, you know, I'm a guy that believes in tradition and keeping up with the ways of your forefathers. So I want to say the old gods, but at the same time, it seems like Lord of Light's the only guy who's able to do anything.
He's the blood magic that the Lord of Light worshippers have actually works.
Yeah, I mean, it would be a very compelling point where it's like, you know, it's not like when I was on my mission, I'm like, take this and pray about it and you'll know and feel. Whereas Lord of Light's like, hey, see that lady? She was dead. Now she's not. See that dude? He was dead. Now he's not.
Elijah and the priests of Baal, right? Rehalar's the one sending down the fire to consume the oxen.
Right, except for the fire actually came down when the priests of Baal were doing their whole song and dance.
Okay, so my...
Which one are you still? Yeah.
Many-faced God. I'm over in the Free Cities.
Of course.
Yeah. They're like, I don't care which religion it is. There is one God, and it is death. All men must die. I'm actually secretly rooting for the faceless men to destroy it all. So I've got some theories about them. I love the idea of a free slave city that's hidden and that institutes like a assassin cult. And I think that they are... I think, one... They are responsible for the doom of Valyria. I think they're the ones who blew up the volcano because it was originated to give the gift among the slaves working in the mines. So I think, one, they did that. And two, I think right now we know that there's a faceless man in the Citadel. And we know he's looking for dragon lore and stuff about dragons because that's where it's all kept. Two, we also I think that they have a dragon egg, the faceless men. Because Euron Greyjoy says he used to have a dragon egg, but he threw it into the sea in a bad mood. But I think that was the price he paid the faceless men for killing his dad, so that he could come back and, like, a faceless man throws him off the bridge. So I think, one, the faceless men have a dragon egg, and two, they're in the Citadel trying to figure out the secrets of dragon magic. And I don't know whether they want to hatch the egg and use it as, like, a weapon of death, or whether they're trying to figure out how to kill the dragon so they can stop Dany. But I'm secretly rooting for the faceless men and these former freed slaves to get their vengeance on everybody.
And yeah, just a very populist position. Everybody's on that. So.
But I mean, if you like Arya, you got to like the people that trained her, right?
Sure.
Jack and Hakkar? How come we didn't name Jack and Hakkar as our favorite character? A man knows.
So, Zach, do you have any crackpot theories that you feel like you need to share?
Crackpot theories?
No, mine are all, like I said, I mean, most of my stuff with the books was as a passive listener going to and from work and dealing with spreadsheets. everything else from the shows, just, it's the same crackpot theories as the general population. Nothing is as deep as the faceless man have a dragon egg and they're going to use it against Dany.
I don't know what they're going to do with it, but...
So, I'd like to maybe close with just like a brief discussion of George R.R. Martin. Do you think that he's going to survive to finish the series?
No.
I don't know. No, probably not. He's an old guy, and he does not look like the Bastion of Health. So...
But here's the thing I think that's going to happen, that could happen, is he knows in his mind what the end is going to be. If he's close to dying, like, he's going to get his thoughts down. His editors know. The showrunners know how it's going to end. They're just going to appoint somebody like a Brandon Sanderson to finish the Robert Jordan series. You know, like, even if he dies, the books are going to get finished and the TV show is going to get finished. So the story is going to be told. I just don't know if he's going to be the one telling it to the end.
No, in a lot of ways, I think that he's probably already gone through and written down the...
Yeah.
He's gotten the Cliff Notes version of his story down.
For sure.
I mean, he's got all your major characters, endings, and everything tied up and finished up. And it's sitting in a safe somewhere in case something were to happen. But whether or not he's the one that tells it, how long has it gone between books?
Six or seven years now.
Six, 7 years between each book. He's got how many more to go? Three?
Well, this one and the next one was what he originally planned, but it seems like they're
just two. But he's hitting it more, yeah.
Well, he always planned for just two more, but it seems like everything that I've seen and read, it notes like it's going to be closer to three. So given that it's taken him 6, 7 years to write it, or it's taken him so long to write this last one because all he's doing is just cranking them out and maybe like, they're all done, guys. Here's this one. You're going to get them all year after year.
And so the other question I have is, like, this isn't a story that has a beginning, really. And it's not a story that seems likely to be like, oh, and then Bilbo drops the ring into the Mount of Doom and everyone's happy thereafter.
Frodo, Steel. Frodo, yeah, come on.
Whatever.
No, George R. He actually, one of the panels that he did that I was watching, he was actually saying, you know, I never intended this show to be the story of Westeros.
Yeah, right.
All I'm doing is I'm capturing a snapshot from a period of time in this land. There were stories and things that happened long before our narrative took place, and there's going to be things that happen long after. You know, and not that I think he was trying to open-end it like, you know, Star Wars, where I want this whole
franchise forever.
extended universe happening. But just trying to add just a note of realism, and that it's not a happy story that's going to have a happy ending. It's something where it's going to be life happened, and it happened very harsh. It happened very fast, and it happened brutally to these people for this period of time. And here's happy. You know, there were some highs and there were some lows.
Yeah.
And that's kind of, and nor do I think it's going to be like everyone's going to die. I think it's going to be somebody got to be a king, and then the story just kind of.
But there has to be some conclusion to this. Not even necessarily the permanent king in place, but with the dragons, all this, there has to be this climax. It's got to be building to something.
Well, so
I feel like the climax has definitely got to be the war between the living and the dead.
Yeah, the others, they fight the others.
Right, and I feel like that's probably where either it'll end there, or then the Faceless Men will show up like heartless bastards and just take out everybody else with their dragon.
So I don't think but what I'm saying is
that's logically where everything's going.
So the thing with the others is the others have appeared before. The others fought men, and eventually they pushed them back and built a wall. And if there was a huge epic story that he could have written 8 books there, it would have ended with them building the wall and the others being on the outside. But they didn't, like, permanently and finally defeat the others. Like, the others are coming back. And they're going to fight the others, but I don't really expect that the story is going to end with, like, permanently and finally resolving the root of these conflicts, and now the king, like, there's going to be a big battle, and maybe they beat the others, and the others are gone, and they do something to commemorate it, and then some other thing happens, or something else happens, and the others come back 8,000 years later, and then you have the third part of this story, or whatever. You know, like, I feel like the kind of fundamental forces that are at war in this universe will remain at war in this universe forever, like our world, you know?
I'm excited. I hope that he does finish it, because I think a lot of the drive for me is the narrative's fantastic, but I like how he writes it. I like his literary style. I think he's a great author. Someone else telling the same story probably would be fun, but it wouldn't be as gripping to me. I don't think it would move quite the same way it does with him. So I hope he survives. That'd be awesome if he suddenly surprised us and said, all 3 books are done. They're just going to come out yearly. Like, I'd be stoked. It'd be the best. That's like Christmas.
Yeah, I would drop the whatever it costs to buy those new, and I never do that.
Oh yeah.
And for me, as the guy who listens to the audiobooks, I just really hope George R. R. Martin finishes the story so Roy Dotrice can go ahead and finish up the books. That guy has got some amazing voices, and he was born in 1923.
Oh, jeez.
You've only got a few years of him left.
he's on the clock, too.
He's 93 years old. There's no way he's going to make it to whatever books George R. R. Martin's got left.
Maybe that's why he's delaying releasing the book until the old guy finishes recording all the voices.
And maybe he's just doing the Siri route. He's just recording every single word in the English language in all 100-plus voices that he does for the book.
Like that old Dan Rather SNL skit.
I can't even maintain, like, 3 voices when I'm reading a story to my girls. Those guys are awesome.
Yeah.
Well, guys, maybe Game of Thrones will never come to an end, but the podcast does have to end. So we always end with some Unchained melodies and book wisdom. And of course, this week, our Unchained Melodies focuses on songs of fantasy. And this is not a sexual thing, but more so dragon related. So I think we've all got one wonderful fantasy song. You know, I'm just going to start us off. I'm so excited about this one. Leonard Nimoy, you guys know him as Spock. You didn't know that he's also just a fantastic musical performer. And this is maybe the greatest fantasy song ever recorded, The Ballad of Bilbo Baggins.
In the middle of the earth, in the land of Shire, lives a brave little hobbit whom we all admire. With his long wooden pipe, fuzzy woolly toes, he lives in a hobbit hole and everybody knows him. Bilbo, Bilbo Baggins, he's only 3 feet tall. Bilbo, Bilbo Baggins, the bravest little hobbit of them all. Peace-loving folks, you know, they're never in a hurry and they take things slow. They don't like to travel away from home. They just like to eat and be left alone. But one day Bilbo was asked to go on a big adventure to the
Kingdom. And if you're impressed by the song, please watch the video.
I can only imagine. That's great. That's really great. When I think epic songs of fantasy, I think of the keyboard virtuoso, former member of the progressive rock band Yes, Rick Wakeman. My dad was really into Rick Wakeman, and when I was in high school, he was, I don't know why, but he's like, Steele, I really need you to get this record. I'm going to get it for you from my next trip to England or whatever. And he comes back with this London Philharmonic Orchestra performing Rick Wakeman's like rock opera called Journey to the Center of the Earth. And it's about the Jules Verne story performed in like total English progressive rock nerd style. And it's amazing. And I'm going to play two tracks. One's real short. It's the kind of text prologue that Zach has recommended called The Raft. And it's followed by an amazing, amazing track called The Battle. This is from Rick Wakeman's Journey to the Center of the Earth.
Having made a raft from wood taken from the giant mushroom forest, with rigging consisting of a mast made of two staves lashed together, a yard made of a third, and a sail borrowed from their stock of rugs, they set sail from the harbor, Port Gruiben, named after Axel's fiancée. With a northwesterly wind propelling them along at about 3 miles an hour, silver beams of light reflected here and there by drops of spray produced luminous points in the eddy created by the raft. Soon, all land was lost to view. 5 days out to sea, they witnessed a terrifying battle between two sea monsters, one having the snout of a porpoise, the head of a lizard, and the teeth of a crocodile, an ichthyosaurus. The other, the mortal enemy of the first, a serpent with a turtle shell, the plesiosaurus.
This is The Battle.
I think I blacked out during that song, Steele, and actually experienced the battle. I think it happened.
That was one kick-ass MIDI file right there, guys.
I love how the whole album, it's, you have the narration that goes between every single song, and it just sounds like a really terrible dungeon master who never allows much dice rolling or anything to actually happen. It's just like, here's a crappy narrative followed by some terrible synthesizers with an orchestra. That's the whole album.
Yeah, it's good. Double platinum.
Thank you, Steele's right, dad. So,
the first thing that came to my mind was Rick Wakeman, and then Steele...
Are you serious?
Yeah, oh yeah. You think I was joking when I said I listened to the whole album at work today to figure out the best songs? No, that was not a joke.
That's amazing.
No, as I was as I was hunched down over there, I was trying to find my like my vinyl copy of this so I could show you guys and be like, I own it. But alas, I have to find where the other three Wickman albums I've got.
Yeah. Do you have the, what is it, The Wives of Henry VIII? That's a classic one. Everybody's got that.
Yeah, I've got that one. So still took mine. So I just went into Spotify and I typed in Dragon.
I did the same thing. And we're like twins.
Turning out Imagine Dragons. I came across the Ninja Sex Party, who has a song called Dragon Slayer.
Whoa.
Yeah, let's go straight into it.
Why, hello there. You're a very attractive young lady. I'd like to ask you out on the hottest of dates. I see that you have a lot of other gentlemen suitors. Allow me to make my case. This guy plays football, but I once won the whole Super Bowl by myself. Yeah.
I think the title we should have actually given for that is Music for Virgins, is what this week's theme.
Why is it that every song about dragons has to be either prog rock or heavy metal? Why are they...
That's a rhetorical question, right?
guys, when I put fantasy into Spotify, I came up with like the coolest German band of all time. I listened to just one or two songs, but really good.
Yeah.
So Spotify, you just enter a word in there, you're on a sweet journey.
That's true.
Well, guys, let's close this down. Book wisdom.
This is from the Book of Thrones. And this is one of the most highlighted passages when readers read it on Kindle. George R. R. Martin writes, "Never forget what you are, for surely the world will not. Make it your strength, then it can never be your weakness. Armor yourself in it, and it will never be used to hurt you. Let them see that their words can cut you, and you'll never be free of the mockery. If they want to give you a name, take it, make it your own. Then they can't hurt you with it anymore." Advice from Tyrion Lannister to Jon Snow, who's sensitive about being called a bastard. But that's really advice for all of us, really. You know? Never forget what you are. Make it your strength.
Coming from Tyrion, it's powerful. I don't know, guys.
That was the worst book wisdom we've ever done. They're good narratives, but they're not much for wisdom, really.
I thought you were quoting Lion King at first.
Yeah. I don't have the pipes of that 93-year-old guy. We should just play his recording of it, and you'd be like in tears.
Oh, man. There's some great ones here. How about love is poison? A sweet poison, yes, but it will kill you all the same.
Yeah,
these passages make these books sound really bad.
Yeah, it's like boilerplate misogyny, really.
Knowledge is a weapon, John. Arm yourself well before you ride forth to battle.
Yeah.
It's like an after school special.
I was going to say, these are like yearbook quotes.
But trust us, the books are really good if you haven't read them.
Yeah. Hey, Dave, just some wisdom for you. Every man should lose a battle in his youth so he does not lose a war when he is old.
Oh, man. Did you just open a fortune cookie or what?
I have that tattooed on my thigh.
Along with your cedar tree?
Yeah. Oh, it's on my heart, man. Yeah.
Well, Zach, thanks for participating in our nerdiest discussion for at least quite some time on Off the Chain.
Oh, man.
We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, guys.
I'll tell you what. I was so glad to just talk about Game of Thrones with somebody. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Good night, everybody.
Good night, good night.
All right, night, guys.
Off the Chain. Welcome to this world, it's Off the Chain.
I would actually rather be a proctologist or a gastroenterologist than a dentist.
Yeah.
That's the worst job on earth, I think.
I feel like dentists are like the summer sales guys of the medical world. Like, they want to get into it for the money, and they want a secure job, and they want to own their own thing, but they don't want to go all the way.
Yeah, dentists kill themselves left and right.
That's what people always say. I wonder if that's really true.
How many dentists do you know over 50? There's your proof.
My dentist, Dr. Craig West.
What's he doing on the side, though? I bet he does something on the side. I bet he's just like a part-time dentist. He's a dental hobbyist.
Dude's a pro. My crown that he did is fantastic.